what we have seen so far, and I think that's not quite what I'm going to resolve right now. But rather, I want to discuss, first of all, a few caveats. One is that I probably have the least experience on bouncing universes of anybody in this room, so I'm hoping just to learn a bit about what people know and think about bounces. But also, I want to view bounces in a phenomenological context of how it changes the questions we ask. And I have some collaborators, Dash is right here, and others with whom we've been stimulated to think about problems that really haven't been discussed before on how to look at data that actually exists, and I'll end at what this impacts. So just to start, what certainly I learned in standard graduate cosmology is that we think of the universe as an initial value problem, or physics in general. You know, you specify your initial conditions, it's an initial hypersurface, and evolve it forward, and then you try to predict what you might observe at a late time, or go the other way around. So some combination of posing an initial value problem. Now, when you have a standard cosmology with at least in principle singular beginning, I mean, obviously there are various ways to do calculations as you approach it limit, and I consider inflation to be one of the tools we have to discuss going into a singular phase. But in the standard approach, you are always forced to specify an initial condition at a singular point in your evolution of space-time. And that leads to challenges, and some of them have solutions, or at least addressed there are ways we can think about that, and I think in inflation, at least in that sense, it's constructive, that, you know, it does make predictions of things you might observe. I'm sure all of these statements are very, very vague, and there's a counterexample to every one of those I made. But qualitative, at least, this is the basic paradigm we have, is that we want to specify the universe at a time when it's difficult to understand and where a lot of things are very singular. So in recent months, we've been motivated by the bounce, at least, paradigm, by the picture that it may be possible to think of the universe in terms of phases when the universe is large and regular, and to try to understand what could all happen. Okay, have we really explored the full space? You know, how many degrees of freedom are there in our universe? And what could you observe? What haven't you looked for? And that's what I wanted to really try to explore a little bit today about, you know, and a bit about the standard law that exists in the literature. And what I think is has been too conservative in the past for just the greater good of physics as a whole. Right? You don't want to paint yourself in and only work on the things that you don't want everybody to work on the exact same thing and never think outside your standard track. I think that's just not good, not healthy for any science. So I was certainly motivated by colleagues very nearby, so Stefan and Neil here. And from my vantage point, I think in this room I come myself an observer compared to most backgrounds here. From this viewpoint, a bouncing universe in my short summary I'm going to describe as a way of describing the transition of a radiation. So I think there's not much controversy that the universe not long ago was radiation dominated. That we've got very good data on. And then what happened deeper into the radiation era is a question. And a way of formulating is to say, okay, so if I want to probe deep into the radiation era, what kind of questions can I ask? So the degrees of freedom I have is a radiation-dominated universe and perturbations in it. And again, the perturbations are things we observe. And you can think of either classical or quantum mechanical techniques and tools to try to trace things back to the beginning or past the beginning, or even ask what the beginning is. So, and the really short cartoon here, and this cartoon that you don't need a computer for to draw, is that if you have a scale factor against conformal time and a radiation error, that's a really simple one. A goes as eta, a straight line, doesn't get any simpler than that. And I thought in this perfect bounce, perfect, I think partially referring to the fact that you have the universe filled by a perfect fluid, which is actually very close to what the universe actually did at not too high a redshift, not too long ago, that you can trace it back. And if you're willing to entertain negative conformal time and negative scale factors, at least for the purpose of discussion, then at least you have a different place where you can ask your questions. Okay. So you can ask if you want to observe something at some finite expansion scale late. You can ask how does that map to a finite expansion time early. And you can ask, you know, can I discuss these two without having to worry too much about something, some special singularity in the middle? Or if I do, how would this point connect the phases when the universe is large? Okay, those are the basic types of questions that from the outside, if you think of this as some kind of magic black box scattering, things go in, things come out, I want to ask, what do I see? It's kind of, and I think it's hard to ask a question of what you see when everything is singular. Okay, it's a singular point when the universe is zero size. Even who is the observer, right? What are we even talking about? I think it becomes a conceptually challenging. But in this context, it is completely straightforward to discuss what happens when the universe is large. And there are a bunch of conceptual issues that have been around. I do recall the argument against that even when I went and studied. That's been a while back now. When I took classes. That there are some conceptual question challenges of even discussing things going into a crunch. So to discuss a bounce, presumably you've got to be willing to detain something going into a crunch. And even there, you have some very basic conceptual obstacles. So if you look at the Wikipedia article on it, and by the way, since we have a room full of experts who presumably will really all disagree with the Wikipedia entry, we should all feel free to go and edit it, and then we can set at least open up the horizon on for casual readers of what's going on. But that basically spells out the perception that's been around since the 80s. And one of the conceptual issues is that modes today that are regular today consist of basically two types of modes. You have waves that you see in the Planck microwave background maps. And one of those modes is one of the allowed modes is a sound wave mode. And one of them is a what we call a decaying mode. Okay, all kinds of modes can decay, including vorticity, including gravitational waves and sound waves. So those decaying modes, if you go into a crunch, become growing modes in the past. And those grow fairly rapidly that by the time you reach Big Bang nuclear synthesis, you might wonder if the universe is even well enough behaved to discuss the creation of elements. So that, in general, the answer is no. It will actually blow up on you before you get there, at least formally. And that has stopped a lot of people. And in fact, if you look at the literature over the decades, that has stopped a lot of people to be willing to discuss the problem of going into a crunch. They said it is at odds with just our existence, it's at odds with the smooth universe, it's at odds with the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. You cannot, you just cannot allow perturbations to be crunched. Same for vorticity, same for the classic things that are well-behaved expanding, are poorly behaved when you compress. And I think we have to ask the question, is that really an issue? And that's basically the question I want to kind of lay out here. And that kind of layout of what I think we know, what I hope we will know, and there's some concrete nonlinear challenges to everyone to see, how we can make progress on some of these conceptual and quantitative.
You had a parenthetic remark saying complex scale factor, which means that the metric is complex, right? Space time.
Well, today's the classic. Well, when I say classical, today's measurements are in a real scale factor or the real variables. But if you take, for example, in the Gielen and Turok approach, then as quantum mechanical contributions want to be considered, you can consider the path integrals away from the real axis. And that allows you to do a calculation of how to trace perturbations through. And when I first, discussed with my colleagues here, it was an interesting consequence that all modes could be computed through the crunch. or the bounds rather, in which case, well, if it's only, you know, if there's only one point that's ill-behaved and everything else is well-behaved, that calculation you can make.
But even if you have a complex geometry, which is not a Truddy's geometry, to calculate the perturbation, the propagation of perturbation, then these equations are not hyperbolic equations, because the metric is not real. Along the path, which is complex, these equations are not hyperbolic equations. So what does it even mean to talk about propagation in the mathematical sense? And what does it mean to talk about even initial conditions in the mathematical sense? Maybe.
I mean, the equations are well defined. I'm not sure why you're worried about hyperbolic.
Propagation.
So there is a unique solution. We found the solution, which is completely unique. If you give boundary dating before the crunch and after, there's a unique solution which
connects them to. There must be something else. You must be implicitly using some other condition to pick up a solution. I got block off. Usually, I got a wave equation where the block operator is the hyperbolic operator, and that tells you that given initial data here, I can have the solution.
If you're doing linear theory, we go nonlinear too. We look at higher order corrections, but each mode just obeys a second order ordinary differential equation. So the issue of hyperbolicity and so on doesn't arise. It's just an ordinary differential equation. You need two boundary conditions to find a solution. And that's what we did. So there's no...
Maybe in the discussion period.
There's no issue.
In the discussion period and the meaning of this, we should discuss.
Yeah, so within the context of perturbation theory, that is all you ever get.
It's
an ordinary differential equation.
Yes.
So I think a lot of these conceptual things is because, and when the universe is large, we don't have this problem. And I think that's why the whole discussion near the singularity has been, if you have the special initial condition at that point, I think there are conceptual questions. But anyways, I that's not what I was intending to talk about here. I was intending to talk about that's why I put in parentheses that this is not really part of this discussion.
The equation will be well-defined and so on in a given coordinate system. If I went to a proper type, for example, or some other type, then which involves the transformation depends on A, then the equation would, then this time parameter itself would become complex. And I'm not sure that the equation is.
The whole formalism we use is completely coherent. We're solving the Einstein equation. The coordinate system doesn't matter.
Yeah,
we would always get the same answer.
But not with complex metrics.
Yes. No, the complex Einstein equations are covariant.
They're covariant.
I think maybe this is kind of, if you're talking about something like tunneling, where you actually have saddle points of the path integral that are in the complex plane, but the actual solutions may not be. So, would that help?
Yeah, maybe we should discuss it. Because I think it's a good thing to agree on.
I think there's maybe a mixture. I think Nick is talking about the relativistic equation of a complex field, and you want to make complex time, which is different.
Correct. So we never make the space-time coordinates complex.
Yeah, you can have complex fields.
The space-time coordinates are real, always. Metric variables are complex.
No.
So the thing I'm trying to give as a first simpler, I think, example here, that already has problems, and those problems are much more real than any problem of complexity, because it's real on a real function. We're not even talking about complex function, talking about a real function. And the simple example, and I'm going to start with the tensor mode, it has some simplicity. It couples more weakly to matter and other things, so I don't have to worry about gauges, I don't have to worry about what's being discussed. With other modes, we'll get to them. We have to be more careful. So tensor modes, when you decompose, at least in linear perturbation, you might think that you have a gauge invariant unique specification of what your degrees of freedom are. It's a second order wave equation. ODE has two solutions, e to the I k eta over k eta. So one of them is sine k, is a regular mode that goes to a constant. That conveniently is the only mode that gets excited in inflation. It's a second order ODE, there's another solution that goes as cos k eta over k eta. And that mode has been the one that has led to discussions and concerns about whether it's meaningful to discuss a universe which has such a mode. So if you view it as going into a bounce and eta goes to zero, cos k eta over k eta blows up very rapidly. It goes up as eta and radiation goes up as a scale factor. That's a very rapid blow up at a redshift of say 10 to the 8 or whatever, 10 to the 10 when you want to do BBN and other good things. You might worry that this is problematic. There have been papers, this is not a new idea. A fairly complete computation I read was Rossmann and Massner, 84. They're not the first, they're not the last. They are a series of papers that go through that. And the basic phenomenon that they discuss is that if you have a, remember that as eta goes to zero at a fixed k, this mode becomes superhorizon. So all this blowing up is happening superhorizon to you. Okay, locally, if I say all I can measure is geodesic deviation, I can ask, you know, if all of the questions I can ask is what is neighboring particle doing, it's not doing anything. It feels less and less about that long wavelength mode, as you can see by changing k instead of eta. And on subhorizon scales, you know, you don't even know this mode exists. Why should you be so worried about a mode that you cannot even measure or feel? Well, that's because it formally blows up superhorizon. And people argue that locally, it should be thought of as an anisotropic universe that is crunching and is expanding at different rates along different axes. This is, has exact solutions even. There are various Bianchi categorizations of such phenomenon. And I'm just going to review the basic, we're talking observations here. So the basic observations this runs into trouble with is, and this is rather technical, that neutrinos freeze out at about 1 MeV cosmic thermal temperature. Okay, and heavy elements, or light elements rather, are made at 0.1 MeV. So it's a factor of 10 in universe expansion factor from when neutrinos freeze out and when you make helium. Just those two events. If the universe expands anisotropically between those two, then the neutrino distribution will be anisotropic when you try to form neutrons and helium, and therefore affect the abundance of helium. Okay, that has an immediate observational consequence. It turns out it happens in such a way that if you make it maximally anisotropic, you get a helium abundance of 0.9 today, which is at odds even with, I love to give bigger error bars on the observations allow, but I think 0.9, even by the most optimistic interpretation of data, is just not going to fly. Okay, so our universe has a lot less than that in helium, and therefore it is fairly safe to say that BBN was not happening with highly anisotropic expansion rates between at least 1 MeV and 0.1 MeV. Okay, that's observationally a constraint you have to explain at least if you're going to allow for any mode to go in order for crunch, allowing for substantial anisotropic expansion. Okay, that is, I think, large reason why this field of bounces has just not been taken seriously in the broader community. You know, people say, well, you know how. And in fact, this number is very small. If you just convert the known adiabatic scalar modes at horizon crossing today, the 10 minus 5, gives you a tensor mode of 10 minus 10, that's inevitable. Trace that backward and that goes nonlinear, okay? Because it's going to give you, you know, you always source sub-horizon, you source growing and decaying mode, you source both modes. Trace that back and this blow up is inevitable. So, you know, yes?
Have people not played with like conservative models of dampening these sort of anisotropic stresses?
I'm going to get there, but that is basically something you have to work towards. So it's the anisotropy that leads to this trouble. And, you know, people have studied this over decades. This was 30 somewhat years ago, where people even solved the full nonlinear reaction models with neutrinos and photons and everything else. You know, this is a well-defined at least problem, at least you would think. The BBN is therefore, because of the large expansion rate involved, thought to give a stronger constraint than the CMB on these decaying modes. And there was a recent paper even last year on analyzing these modes and always concluding that this is really not allowed. So let me step back a little bit and just count what we have, what you have to specify, your degrees of freedom, and see how that maps onto each other. So let's say we're going to go into a crunch, okay, and let's see what do I have to specify to even describe what I'm crunching here. In the very simplest setup, I'm going to stick to this perfect fluid model, just because it's simple and it's got the fewest degrees of freedom that I know of any model at least. that, you know, you've got the fluid, it's got nothing else, there's no other fields, there's only a perfect fluid with perturbations in it, and the space-time itself, which has perturbations as well. I can't think of anything was simpler. So that alone is the consideration here. And the universe actually is well described by such a setup, that's even more convenient. If to specify, and I'm only going to consider the tensor fluctuations of the space-time, because that's what we're talking about here, plus something a fluid may or may not do. So the tensor, it's a second-order differential equations. There are two there's a second-order ODE, there are two polarizations. This two means per polarization. Initial conditions I have to specify. And the fluid requires four initial variables to specify. Okay, there's a density and three velocities that I need to tell you what I'm trying to bounce here, what I'm trying to crunch here. And in principle, if you say this formally looks nonlinear on superhorizon scales, well, you have to say how am I going to do this calculation? I think a lot of nice things in Stefan's and Neil's paper is they went through a lot of the work for us at up to second order, where you can see that actually this calculation is at least makes sense. You can actually calculate it and discuss it. And I'm going to go a little bit about what the types of things that that will happen. Naively, you might have said, well, if I take the expanding universe and take the Bianchi anisotropic model, that is basically a 1 degree of freedom if you map it into this language and pick and rotate your coordinates to have the anisotropy vector along the anisotropy axis. That is looks a lot like a decaying mode, tensor mode, coming out of the Big Bang. And it decays, meaning by the time, at late times, that actually looks very isotropic. And then you might naively think, well, so this of these 6 degrees of freedom, one of those dimensions is probably mapped onto this Bianchi degree of freedom, you might think. And you might wonder, well, so if I excite that mode, am I inevitably going to have some highly nonlinear process happening, and therefore this is very hard to, way before I get to any quantum phenomenon, my universe is already in trouble. So here I'm going to give you
Really, why are you? I would have thought two.
Sorry?
I would have thought two of the tensor modes map onto the Bianchi. You say
well, it depends on the counting. So the way I put it is per polarization. Well, if I count them as being six, then only the decaying tensor one. No, that's the polarizations too, of course. You know, they are more degrees of freedom.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's just the.
But count, you have to, maybe with the counting. So I'm going to give another amusing exact solution that has the same problem, and let's just see what kinds of problems actually exist when you have fluids without gravity, okay? An even simpler problem, and you might wonder, well, how can I have the growing modes and singularities when I don't even have gravity? And that's what's called the Milne slicing of Minkowski space. We know that an empty space can be a hyperbolically curved spacetime, and the metric is the Milne, it's just a hyperbolic metric, omega curvature of one, I guess, in this coordinate. You can, it's just a re-coordinate change from Minkowski, mind you, not a small one. This is not, you know, usually we talk about small gauge reslicing. This is a big gauge reslicing. You're only covering a subset of your original Minkowski space. And we can now put a test fluid on there. By test fluid, I'm just putting tracer particles in there that don't gravitate by definition. And you can ask, well, if we do that, we put a test fluid in Milne space, okay? This is empty space, Minkowski. There's nothing happening in this space, okay? You're not going to convince me this is gravitationally unstable because the equations I've given you are there is no gravity, so it cannot be unstable. G is zero. Now, these modes decay. It's an expanding fluid. Okay, the slicing is one of a fluid. I set up my fluids to be going outward, like an explosion of a nuclear bomb or something. And any perturbations I had initially from the expansions will decay. Okay, so all solutions in the Milne space decay at some rate. Meaning, if you take this back, if you think of it as a crunch going in, well, these modes blow up again. You know, they've got the same problem. And clearly, this is not a gravitational instability. This is just saying, well, okay, if I wanted to set up a fluid that all shoots toward one point, you know, one of the particles isn't aimed the right way, you know, this is going to be off by a large amount. So that's kind of, in this description, kind of a trivial wording, saying that, I can set up a singular initial condition for my fluid, and because this fluid is moving at close to the speed of light and therefore highly supersonically in its own frame, you know, I'm just shooting fluid particles supersonically all toward the point, and they can do really nasty things. As I try to imagine in a lab trying to do an inverse nuclear bomb and wanting to, your missile to rematerialize, that's going to be hard. Okay, it's probably not going to happen. It's probably going to be impossible. But that's not the same as saying that it's going to be gravitationally unstable. There are other problems, but gravity is not one of them. Okay, that's it.
Gravity could be one of them, but that's not.
In this example.
No, even without gravity.
Yes, without gravity, there are fluids, apparent divergences, but they arise because of the way I set up my fluid slicing. I just wanted to distinguish. When I have these degrees of freedom, I can have just even the fluid. I have to be careful. All I'm saying is you have to be careful counting how many degrees of freedom you actually have and how many of them I'm just making unstable ad hoc, even though nobody would. I don't think anybody in this room would say, oh, fluids are intrinsically unstable. This has nothing to do with fluids being intrinsically unstable. This is, you know, if you really, really look at it and have a perverted definition of your fluid initial conditions and a perverted definition of instability of a fluid, you will conclude that all fluids are unstable. Okay, that's probably not a useful description, and most people would, I think, agree that I'm not going to conclude from this that therefore all fluids are intrinsically unstable. That's not quite the right message to take home. Okay, so but I'm just saying you have to be careful of how you slice things and how you set up your fluid variables. Okay, I'm going to jump to the next one. So Dash over here has been working on the scalar mode. And here is something that is actually can be compared to observations, for example. You will see normally the green is the CMB temperature power spectrum that you've seen an infinite number of times, which maps the data perfectly. And there's no need to put data points on for this purpose of discussion. You can ask, well, in the scalar world, there are again 2 degrees of freedom. In the perfect fluid case, there are still exactly 2. And you can ask, well, what happens if you excite the other one? Well, the other one is 90 degrees out of phase by construction. So that gives you this kind of blue set of perturbations if you had a decaying mode present as well. The data obviously is very consistent with the green and probably not so consistent with the blue. So if I try to convince you the blue fits the data, it probably wouldn't. But at least you can say this is a degree of freedom that is allowed by the kinematics, okay, that you might be able to measure. That you could have measured. Yes, Robert?
How are the amplitudes normalized?
So here's a fundamental conceptual question: is that if I have a mode that's divergent, if you look at what people have done in the past, it's clearly redshift dependent of how you normalize the modes. Now these adiabatic sound waves separate, and they are just sound waves; they go as coscators. So separating these two modes' amplitudes, I can compare. Supervising. Yeah, things are hard to compare, you know, it's hard to even ask, and it's slicing dependent. And if you look at, you know, Stefan and Neil's papers, in some gauges they diverge, other gauges they don't. So it's clearly, you know, you have to be careful what you mean. So what we are trying to do here is to normalize them separating where we don't have this ambiguity. And then we can just say what fraction of the separating amplitude could have been there at the at going into the horizon crossing. Okay, so it's really only things below the horizon that you can really measure and discuss. And this is one of the examples.
And this is age time in the expanding phase.
This is at redshift 1100 when we observe the CMB. This is meant to be the CMB oscillation power spectrum.
But this could be in the contracting phase too, right? You would just normalize it in the same
exactly, way. Exactly. In the contracting phase, you might say, well, you know, if I'm not careful, I'm going to populate both modes. In general, if I don't know when my crunches are happening when I generate my modes, I might generate them both and send them both in. And if they both come out the way you send them in, you might have a random combination of those two. That's, you know, would be one possibility at least. So that's something you want to think of, you know, if you think that's not being observed, then you'd have to map, you know, why might it not exist? Or conversely, if you were to observe such a mode, that would be hard to explain if you, in an inflationary context where these modes actually would be very difficult to source at inflation. Okay, certainly at a very high redshift, these are superhorizon. It's non-trivial to source a superhorizon going mode in any other context. So here are, you know, very concrete things that are potential, that are in the spectrum of observability, that could be observed. And you know, so A, I think people, you know, when we discuss and present the possible outcomes to observers, we should include that as one of the degrees of freedom. It's like saying, you know, tensor mode, maybe they don't exist, maybe they do exist. We don't want to tell them, oh, you will absolutely find them there, and then...
We know what happens when you do that.
So similarly, here you should say, you know, these are the kinematically allowed degrees of freedom, and, you know, map your data onto all degrees of freedom. Maybe you see them, or maybe you don't, and that's the domain of the fundamental theory of learning. You know, if you found a mode, well, that would be big news. So, you know, if you tell the observers, finding a decaying mode is at least as profound as finding a tensor mode. And we already know that the tensor amplitude is also smaller than the scalar amplitude, which is unfortunate observationally, because we could have learned a lot if we had seen it. But obviously, they're not by any means giving up, okay, because they understand it. They could still observe it. And similarly, of course, this is a calculation you can do for polarization and cross spectra. These are all kinds of you know, the straightforward extensions. You can in principle do this for tensor modes. I believe Shin was here and Dash are thinking about how to do that. It turns out when you have two tensor modes in the computation, an amusing thing that's presumably going to happen is that the two tensor modes can lead to two different B modes, which could cancel, for example. But it just means that if you want to translate a non-observation of a B mode to a tensor amplitude, you have to include more information. Okay, in the absence of information, you would just say, okay, maybe there weren't any, maybe there's some that canceled, and you have to, at least you have to be, you have to specify more. You can't just say, my amplitude is known to be H tensor less than some number. It's more complicated. Okay, it's really, you've measured a combination.
So yes. This amplitude that you choose, if now, you run, as you were saying, you run back to BBN, then one of them gets bigger and bigger, right?
That's okay. So now you ask, you know, the question that I posed is, and that's to close the loop on all these threads, that is it really a problem that these modes are appear to be growing? And it's only a problem if the gravity actually doesn't require a fortuitous alignment of the velocity to actually generate that apparent nonlinearity. Because if you recall, in perturbation theory, at first, second order, you don't feel that long wave in superhorizon tensor mode at all. So how would the fluid suddenly know to do something fishy when it can't even feel a force? Okay, there's nothing pushing on the fluid. How would the neutrinos know to stream anisotropically if nothing is pushing them? Okay, just causally, if you go backwards, you know, how would the neutrinos ever know to have a different temperature if there's no force acting on them? So what matters is geodesic deviation, and we don't see any at first and second order. Now, okay, maybe something nonlinear can happen, and that's, I think, a question that can and should be studied. It's a well-defined problem. It's not even computationally that hard. So again, I think this opens up the challenges to theory of saying, okay, let's solve this. Okay, that's an equation. This equation even isn't, it's just a classical equation. This equation is well-defined. And I'd be curious to see, you know, how do you reconcile these two statements that fluids perturbatively see nothing at all happening from these supposedly growing modes, and yet naively they seem to map onto one of the Bianchi modes going the other way. So maybe it's some singular mapping that you really have to work on the fluid at late time singularly to make it crunch into this anisotropic phase, or maybe it's non-generic, like in the Milne case. The Milne case, I would call a non-generic singularity in your fluids. Okay, this is, you have to really build this in the final condition to ever have it happen. So a generic fluid will not exhibit that. So here's a question, is it generic or not?
Okay, what do you mean by that some fluids exhibit all sort of non-linear in its energy cascades up and down?
That's right, and in this cascade, is, for example, it cascades up and down, but it doesn't suddenly go singular in this cascade, right?
Well, you have to depend, well,
I mean, the local density, the local density contrast, if I just, you know, wave my hand here, I don't get suddenly order one of order one density fluctuations in this room. You know, that's highly unlikely. Again, I understand in statistical mechanics, there's a very small chance that all my atoms end up. But I call that a, you know, a highly unlikely event that waving my hand suddenly causes all the energy in this room to condense to a point. Okay, then that's the question. How is that generic? That, you know, you have. But again, these are all things we can compute and answer. Similarly, when you have these things, you can ask, is there an issue of back reaction? And again, these are things that we can now have a framework. Back reaction has also been a conceptually challenging, and I know some of you have thought about this problem in this room, how do you pose this question? Because you have to be able, you know, specify things at some wedge at one slice and then observe it at another slice, map it across. Make sure that, you know, the averaging over horizons, I think people disagree on how you define these things. Whereas in a bouncing universe, at least the conceptual issues are decoupled. Okay? Decoupled meaning as I go into a crunch, sure, I can tell you what I averaged, I can tell you what I sent in, and then if I give you a prescription for the bounce at the other side, I can again make a measurement when the universe is large and unambiguous. Okay, and in between, I just have some mapping, and at least I can ask a question. Before, we couldn't even ask a question. We couldn't even agree what the question was. Whereas here, at least, there is a space in which we can pose and discuss a question. And obviously, the same goes for the other modes, vector modes that aren't discussed very often. But of course, you know, actually, one of the Bianchi's, I forgot which type, deals with rotation and vector modes. And again, you know, how generic is that? So all these things, I think what I find exciting is that we have a larger theory space to explore, data to compare with, and that's progress, right? This is a paradigm that allows us to think further. And I think the engineer's question, it's a question mark, right? Is the Bianchi solution a singular perturbation or is it a generic one? I don't know. I think that would be good to answer. I think there are two ways of thinking about it. One tells you that you cannot get there in the reverse unless you work really hard at it. And obviously, that's not what people used to think. So that brings me to the end here. That I think I'm very upbeat about this whole new vision that we can entertain a broader spectrum of observational outcomes than people normally consider. That must be good for science. And there's some really simple things that you can immediately do without the calculation. Obviously, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that I can always, with more degrees of freedom, there could be cancellations, there could be all kinds of things. That's immediately obvious. In detail, you can do more calculations. As I mentioned, clearly you double a lot of mode counts. So certainly the scalar and vector mode, scalar and tensor modes immediately have twice the number of degrees of freedom that you can try to compare with data. And not to mention that the fluid has its own, and just the fact that it does have its own, I think is something that hasn't been appreciated, because in the Bianchi case, you pick an equation of state, so this isotropy, you force your fluid to lie in your coordinate labels, okay? You basically pick, it's fine, but just saying that's a very specific implicit requirement on your fluid initial state, that it is, you know, not moving at the velocities at rest in that particular coordinate choice. If I relabel it, then obviously it might not be. So this is, I think, the discussion that is open to pursue. Thank you.
Without the gravity, we can actually visualize what happens. And indeed, what happens is that you generically, the fluid particles miss each other. And what goes in is very, very different from what comes out, because you're going to have entropy production at the bounce, right? So I'm just wondering whether basically that suggests that idea of basically a smooth bounce may not, at least in the FRW foliation, is not the correct assumption, because what goes in is very different from what comes out. I don't see why it would be homogeneous, basically, the thing that comes out in any sense.
Well, I think you have to map that to the calculation where, even classically, you know, they get a solution of modes, including high-order perturbations, going in order by order. And that's one thing. I think this is something which can be discussed in a controlled environment, okay, in the bounds case. So obviously, with infinite volumes, you have to be a bit careful of where you think you're imposing your perturbations.
Well, the calculation that Stephen alluded is not a milled universe, it's a radiation.
Understood,
problem.
Exactly.
So
it's a big, exactly. So
the milled universe case, I think there is a genuine problem going through the bounds. Because, I mean, particles generically miss each other.
Well, you see, okay, let's just try this conceptually. If I send a gas and no gravity, just going in,
yeah,
it'll go in and it'll probably come out again. What fraction of the perturbations comes out, I don't know the answer. My guess is a lot of the energy has to come back out again.
If they don't interact with each other, yeah, then everything that goes in. But I mean, if there is any interaction there, then...
Well, at the end of the day, most of your energy is the one that you sense the stuff going in there supersonically. And it's a single degree of freedom fluid, right? You only have P and, you only have rho equal to P equal to rho... P equal to rho over 3. So you've got a unique equation of state. There's only one thing that can happen. Yes, you may get shocks, you may get all kinds of things. But at the end of the day, the energy is going to force the fluid to go back out again at the end of the day. And indeed, I think that's a good example of trying to see, you know, what would happen. I think that a lot of energy will come back out again. I don't think it'll all stay in the middle.
Sure.
That's
it,
unlikely.
It does come back, but the question is, do you return the FRW symmetry?
Right? That's a good question. To what extent at least? Because remember, everything decays again on the way out. Okay, and the way out, I mean, yeah, things, strange things happen, and the way out, things do get regular again. And yeah, that's a good question, right? That's exactly, that's even easier to simulate. Okay, so anybody who has got a gas code, this we don't even need gravity, just send gas in and see what comes out.
Well, what do you mean? If you're not adding any dissipation into the problem, it's going to come out exactly what you put in.
No, a perfect fluid still has entropy production.
Shock. Yeah, but you have to put that in. Either you're going to have it now.
No, if it's collision, no, collisionless, right? If you say it's, if you stick the Maxwellian, require collisional Maxwellian perfect fluid, then, I mean, sure, if you're collisionless, obviously, if you need neutrino fluid, it'll come out the way you put in. But I can add a twist that it does interact with itself non-linearly. And the question is, well, something will still come out, you know, how similar will it be? That's a quantifiable question. So, you know, I'm saying we shouldn't be afraid of this. This is actually computable.
Yeah, but in what context are you learning anything? I mean, you're going to be learning the amount of extra physics you put in. I mean, aren't you at some point just working a problem that might be taking you away from the problem that
well,
you're
Well, a perfect fluid is a pretty good description of the early universe. So mean free paths of photons is very, very short at the early universe. So I don't think that's an exotic equation of state to choose here, right? That's what fluids do when you crash them into each other. And in fact, it may even shed light on things like, you know, heavy quark, what they call it, these quark gluon plasma collisions. Basically, all you do is you crunch shoot a bunch of stuff together and let it come back out again. So in fact, I think this has brought, you know, questions that you get to answer when you just shoot things together. What happens? Is there mode conversion? Of course, it's very different from the perfect, from the gravitating fluid universe. But nevertheless, I think these are all questions that are opened up.
What controls the, as I understand it, the discussion you're talking about is all happening classically, that these calculations you'd be doing would be thought about. But what's controlling the quantum corrections at the bounds?
So in the perfect bounds model, classically, you see exactly coming out what went in. So as far as when the universe is large again, there is no effect of the quantum effects during the bounds. But I'm sure Neil and Stefan would be happy to elaborate on.
Yeah, so that's what we calculate. So if you send in the vacuum, quantum vacuum, we calculate what comes out.
But how do you know that in the calculation you did, it was a semi-classical calculation?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But how do you know that was a good approximation? I mean, what's the small parameter that controls the things that you didn't include in that approximation?
We're doing linearized gravity. Right? So the small parameter would be...
But it's linearized versus nonlinear happens even within the classical approximation, but then there's a separate thing as to what's controlling the loop expansion, if you like.
We did do second order and higher order contributions, but I think basically the statement would be is that at the initial time when we define the vacuum, the in vacuum and the out vacuum, the density is much less than Planck density.
But when you say higher order, what's the small parameter that is higher order in? Because normally the way I think about loop corrections is that they're controlled by the Planck scale divided by some other scale, which is normally the size of the universe or something. So in the bounds, that's exactly where it's dangerous. And so
yeah,
it sounds like you have something else that's controlling it.
Okay, so the framework is that you define the initial state to be the ground state of the quantum perturbations long before the bounds. Then you find a Fermat solution, which is a saddle point of the path integral between the in state and the out state. Right? You don't look at the bounds and see exactly what's going on there, just like you don't look right at a particle collision. You define the in state and the out state, just let the theory find the saddle point. So the fact that the density is diverging at the bounds, you know, is fully taken into account.
So if I look at the fluctuations around the saddle point, how does that, it sounds like there's some property of the saddle point that's going to control the size of those fluctuations. And what is the small thing that does that?
I mean, our point was that those fluctuations have smooth evolution right the way through. And when you include second order corrections and so on, you don't see any divergence. So at a semi-classical level, there are no divergences. That's a strange thing.
I guess
perturbation theory is controlled by its validity in the in state and the out state.
The perturbation theory in one small thing, that's the thing I don't want to see.
H-bar.
But H-bar is a better dimension, so the H-bar compared to what?
It's defined by the initial geometry.
So it's like the action of the... So then why does the action stay small? It should be that there's a parameter, I get to choose something in the problem. A small dimensionless number and expand in that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would normally do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing that I think...
There is a small dimensionless number, which is, roughly speaking, the mass of the universe. As compared, I mean, you've got a big background, right? Background is itself quantum mechanical. And so we showed that there's, in a sense, a mass of the universe. You could think of taking a co-moving scale, and the density times volume is approximately its mass. And then the quantum fluctuations in the scale factor of the universe go to zero as that mass becomes infinite. Now, when you put the perturbations in, these are modes in that background. So, for example, I took a torus, you know, you have the mode number, and then you study mode by mode what happens there. But there really is only one dimensionless number that's controlling the whole thing.
I mean, if I were to describe to Cliff what the way I understand it, which is probably at a much more naive level there, is if you think of a scattering of a Coulomb potential, right? I take Alex one and scatter, and Rutherford did that a few years ago. And you might have wondered, well, he never knew about the virtual sea of electrons and photons, that if you shoot hard enough, this classical calculation he did, which actually gave him the right answer, by the way, surprisingly enough, he didn't know about any QE quantum mechanics, well, basically. In fact, his calculation and his results had zero quantum mechanics in it. He gets the scattering angle of electrons coming out, which even if you go close compared to the Bohr radius to the proton, you happen to get the same amplitudes coming out. Now you would say, well, okay, and if you did a classical path integral of just a single degree of motion particle, you would get the same answer too. You might say, well, but you forgot about the fact that if I really get close enough to the nucleus, I can generate pairs of, pair production of positrons and other things. And, you might worry about these, what you call loops, might take me away again, right? Well, again, I would have said, okay, so let's calculate this, right? Let's calculate how much the electric field changes because my electron's coming in. So I want to now consider not only a classical single degree of freedom object going through, but I want the background to be able to have some degree of freedom and simultaneously propagate this through. And that's what they did. Okay, they said, and then it looks okay, at least at next order up, nothing interesting happened. They don't excite each other. So it's like saying, if it's not true for the Coulomb atom, in the sense that if you actually calculate the electric field generated by the electron as it gets close to the nucleus, you might worry, oh, I'm seeing Schwinger production or something as I'm close. They don't, right? So you'd say, okay, it just goes through and the forces calculate. There is no Schwinger production, unlike in the Coulomb problem. And okay, so there's no reason to really think that I need more things. At least I think that's the way I understand the analogy.
So the philosophy is just do the calculation and see if anything goes wrong. And what we found is nothing goes wrong.
The worry though is the calculation you're doing, the thing is you're not solving the whole problem, you're just setting up a semi-classical calculation and you're thinking that that's a good approximation to what the system really did, right?
Yeah, so the way you learn that is by seeing if the second order correction is large. And we computed the second order correction, it's not large. So now you could say, well, maybe third order is going to be large. So we tried to make general arguments about higher orders, but that's the philosophy. So if perturbation theory doesn't fail, the result has a chance of being reliable.
If the perturbation theory doesn't fail,
yes, which it doesn't. Do you know, it's a question of how well you know. So you compute second order, third order, try to anticipate, or is there any problem coming from higher orders? And basically, we couldn't see any problem.
And it's more interesting that there's more correction. There's no correction. I mean, that's a stronger statement, right? That's like saying I scatter electrons off nuclei, and I calculate the backreaction energetic field, and if my conclusion was there was none.
Coming back to the back reaction question, I didn't understand what the setup here is, because I think the back reaction to me would be, geometry changing throughout, right, because of back reaction.
Yes.
And so it's not just a scattering issue anymore.
If it were to back react, it would be a non-scattering issue.
Right.
But I think the question that can be posed normally is challenging. Because you've got to take an ensemble average over things that are going non-linear on you, and it's not entirely clear how you even discuss this. As we saw, all these motors blowing up, and this has been discussed also in cosmology of quantum and other scenarios. And usually, it's just very hard to even agree on who does the averaging and who's the observing and what are you doing. Here you can do it at least.
Also, like Ronald said, this issue about since one gauge you get find divergent and one gauge you don't find divergent, then why should I trust any of them?
Okay.
If there's a good gauge, and there's a family of good gauges, then that's a reliable calculation. Just like in the short shell geometry, some coordinate systems are singular, metric, other ones are regular.
The gauge invariant quantity, like the white tensor square.
Normally, if we find a family of coordinate systems which are regular, then the solution is a legitimate solution.
Why not just? The background is in public flat. You could just, and you look at tensor modes. You could just look at the wild curvature, right? And that should be gauge invariant. That linearized wild curvature, that is completely gauge invariant. So either it's well here or it's not.
Well, many of the gauges we use are gauge, so-called gauge fixed, right, or gauge invariant. So.
It doesn't matter. Even if it's gauge fixed, it's still calculated.
This is not a big issue or a concern. I just state that.
But it's mine.
No, you can always create a singularity by bad.
No, but I agree with that. But on the other hand, I think, as you said, for short shift, the way we do it, we just calculate the curvature invariant and see that's fine. We could do the same thing.
I think that depends. You have to be one thing. You have to ask the question in an observable way, right? So just to look at them, it's blowing up. That alone may not be observable. So it's like in a Coulomb potential, things blow up.
As pointed out in his opening talk, there are two issues. One is observations. One
yes.
One is theoretical consistency. I'm talking about
no, but even theoretically, there's that thing, right? I'm talking about theoretically now. A variable blowing up on you, and you look at a variable, it looks very big. But whether or not you care that it's big only depends on whether there is, there are different ways of saying observable. Is there an operator that ever cares about this? And if the answer is no, I don't worry. So for example, is the impulse imparted in the test particle finite or not? Is it reducing deviation between two test particles? Is there any local hypothetical observations they could make to know about? And if they cannot, I would say, you probably shouldn't worry about it, right?
Okay, but that's the case you had a question you're asking.
Exactly, that's the point, exactly. It depends on the wild tensor, but...
Any physical question is gauge invariant.
Exactly.
Yeah. So those are exactly the questions.
Exactly. And there the answer is no, they don't feel a geodesic deviation.
I'm saying the same thing. So I'm saying that there's a way to address this question, not what you want. But the other thing is that in passing, you say something like the mass of the universe. So all this is done in a compact case, especially compact.
In principle, yes, but that's just a technical device. You imagine a torus of some volume V. And then you imagine all the perturbation modes, and then everything is finite, and you study the bounds, and then in the end, you're interested in whether any of the results depended on that volume. So, just a technical device to make everything
better. But that technical device is important to address Flip's question, right, about one-way approximation.
So the
question is whether this technical device fails when you take the infrared limit and let it goes to infinity.
Yeah, that's certainly true. So what we have in mind is that the volume is bigger than the volume of our current observable universe. In principle, if we could do the calculation in light cones, we'd prefer to do that. just talk about what we actually see. But in practice, it's easier to use torus in a flat universe, for example.
I have to say, this is really very nice. I mean, just to say a statement. So the questions I think are people are asking because it is very nice, and therefore one wants to understand it better.
So yeah, I don't know, we should have a little bit of open discussion, I guess, before we break for lunch. Maybe another 10 minutes or so. We're running a bit late for the
maybe
for
some
talk.
Other people would
contribute to yes, that. So questions for both speakers, I guess, today, and related topics.
I have a very nice question for you.